Well, this is Martin Sheen, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities, are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now to news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Unemployment benefits last week. It's another sign that layoffs remain low and that most Americans enjoy a measure of job security. The Labor Department reported today that jobless claims dropped to 206,000 last week from a revised 212,000 the week before. Claims for jobless benefits are a proxy for layoffs, and economists watch them because they can be a harbinger for where the job market is headed. For the past year, claims have been at an historically low range of around 200,000 to 230,000 a week. Still hiring this year remains well below the 166,000 monthly jobs created on average in 2023 and 2024, let alone the 491,000 a month recorded during the 2021-2022 hiring boom that followed pandemic lockdowns. South Korea's military says North Korea has launched about 10 short-range ballistic missiles toward the sea. The move comes a day after North Korea dismissed the U.S. decision to scale back military drills with South Korea. Nick Harper reports.
To get a denuclearization deal done with North Korea would be a huge foreign policy win, a huge win for any president at any point in their presidency. But Donald Trump is currently a president who looks like a president who needs a foreign policy win. His Gaza peace deal was signed and delivered last year, but it's limping along. It hasn't really come to fruition. And then there's Iran. That peace deal remains very elusive.
That's Nick Harper. Moderna shares more than doubled after announcing initial results from a study of an experimental skin cancer treatment. More from Ishan Garg.
Moderna and Merck have announced the first ever positive phase 3 results for a personalized mRNA cancer vaccine in melanoma patients, a breakthrough that has sent both companies' share prices sharply higher. The trial tested the vaccine Intismeran alongside Merck's immunotherapy drug in more than 1,100 patients whose tumors had been surgically removed, and the company says it significantly reduced the risk of cancer returning. Moderna's president has said thousands of patients could benefit as soon as next year, with the therapy already on an expedited review pathway with regulators in the United States and Europe. From Feature Story News in New Delhi, I'm Ishan Garg.
A former engineering director at Meta, who has testified before Congress about child safety on Instagram, told jurors at a landmark trial in Oakland that the company took a don't ask, don't tell approach on kids under 13 on its platforms. During his second day of testimony on Wednesday, Arturo Bejar said Meta consistently prioritized profits over safety in designing its products. The trial began Tuesday in federal court. It pits Meta against the states of California, Colorado, Kentucky, and New Jersey, and it is expected to last about 6 weeks. The company has rejected the claim and said evidence at the trial will show its commitment to safety. The United Nations warns that more than 200,000 people have been newly displaced across Sudan's Kordofan region due to intensified fighting since late last year. The report comes as continued drone attacks target critical water and electricity infrastructure in the region's biggest city, El Obeid. The UN's International Organization for Migration, or IOM, released the warning Wednesday as seasonal flooding in nearby North Darfur state also compounded the displacement crisis. The civil war in Sudan erupted in 2023. It came amid a power struggle between Sudan's army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. As many as 150,000 people have been killed, and some 14 million people have been displaced, although experts say the casualty numbers are likely much worse. The UN has designated it the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The IOM said that in El Obeid, drone attacks by the RSF on the city's main power transformer have knocked out electricity needed to pump water, run hospitals, and keep phone lines working. The UN and human rights organizations have accused the RSF of carrying out a coordinated ethnic cleansing campaign against non-Arab communities that could amount to genocide. Those are the headlines. I'm Max Pringle on KPFA.
Those were the news headlines from Pacifica Radio. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. Today on Sojourner Truth, we commemorate Black August with professor and movement lawyer James Simmons. Then we talk beyond Haitian TPS with Baji's Director of Policy and Advocacy, Ronald Claude. And finally, a revisit of our conversation with Florida State Representative Angie Nixon, who just won a stunning U.S. Senate primary victory as a lefty progressive in the state of Florida. All this and more on Sojourner Truth. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. August 21st is one of the high holy days of Black August, a commemoration of Black resistance and revolution that was born in the California state prison system. Today marks the day that Soledad prison guards killed Comrade George Jackson, Field Marshal of the Black Panther Party, who had been sentenced to prison for 1 year to life, indeterminate sentence. Pleased to be joined by James Simmons to discuss the origins of Black August, a few of its traditions, and its relevance today. James Simmons is a longtime movement attorney, a professor at Cal State Northridge, and a co-founder and member of Black August Los Angeles. Greetings, James. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Nana, for having me.
Very important. We're in the middle. So, you know, I'm a little behind. We've been running, trying to support folks all over the place in this world of the regime. But wanted to make sure, before it got too late, that we did do at least a brief conversation around Black August. You would share with the people, just in case there's some that do not know, what the spirit, the energy, the purpose of Black August is.
Black August is rooted in the resistance of African people, Black people, in the wilderness of North America, on the continent of Africa, and in the diaspora. It's rooted in the Haitian Revolution, started in August. It's rooted in the Watts Rebellion, which was August 11th, 1965. It's rooted in all those acts of rebellion, of counter-terrorism, where people were martyred, where people were imprisoned, people were exiled, but most importantly, where people resisted white supremacy and tried to achieve self-determination and independence. The more contemporary roots of Black August are, it came out of the California prisons where racist guards, their accomplices in the white supremacists within the prison would attack Black inmates, and those inmates found it necessary to, again, defend themselves and aggressively. And after a series of back and forth violence where guards were killed, Black inmates were killed and tortured, wound up in a courthouse rebellion with several people, Jonathan Jackson, James McClain, and William Christmas, who all died along with a judge in August 7th, 1970, and with the assassination of George Jackson on August 21st, 1971. And it really kicked off when one of the architects of Black August was killed in an accident on the yard, and the prison authorities failed to give him life-saving medical care. And that is the contemporary root of Black August.
And we know that there are some traditions in Black August. There are flea days, we'll start with them. And then there are some things that we are asked to do during Black August. Share those quickly, please.
Yeah, the flea days include those days I mentioned, August 7th and August 21st, with the murder of George Jackson and the killing of Jonathan Jackson, James McClain, and William Christmas. August 13th is, and they're called flea days. August 13th commemorates the killing after an attack by racist white inmates on three Black inmates, those who taught George Jackson what the radical ideology and organizing that they were the guerrillas, and they were killed by a prison guard after during a fight with racist white inmates. The guard did not shoot the white inmates, but killed the Black ones. So that is on the 13th. And then the first, where Kotari Galdon, again, one of the architects of Black August, was killed in that unfortunate accident that turned into medical, basically an assassination by medical neglect.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpfee, and I'm in conversation with professor, movement lawyer, and co-founder of Black August Los Angeles, James Simmons, about the commemoration of Black August and its relevance today.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
Si porque te quiero, quieres llorona.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpfee.
There is a really important and always, you know, it's like somber but delightful, all the emotions, all the feels, bus tour that is done in Los Angeles, a martyrs tour. Can you share a bit in the last minute or so about that and when it is, so that folks that are in the Los Angeles area are able to come, but also what it is?
Yeah, the Martyrs Tour will be And it is an annual event. It will be held on August 22nd. It will take off from Chuco's Justice Center at 76th Street and Central Avenue. It is a tour of places of resistance, resilience, and martyrdom. Los Angeles is full of those places, from the Watts Rebellion to the 1992 Rebellion in Los Angeles. Nana, and I know you're intimately familiar with that rebellion, having been there. The attacks upon different forces within and leadership in the Black community and the masses. So you get to see where these things took place. You get to see the graveyards of those who were fallen. I want to remind people that Black August is never intended to be a celebration, but a commemoration, and to get people to recognize that that there were martyrs, that we stand on the shoulders of those who gave their lives and their freedom, whether in the prisons or in exile, and that this is something that we need to remember and push forward for liberation and self-determination. If you would like to go on the tour, email blackaugustla@gmail.com. Suggested donation is $10, and the bus was full. We had two extra vans last year, and it was still overflowed. So try to come get it in early.
Get it in early, because it is always overflowed. Thank you so very much, James. Really appreciate you. Appreciate you coming on, sharing the information. Look forward to hooking up with you soon.
All right. Appreciate you, Nana, putting us on. Salamu Agosti Waves, Black August greetings.
Black August Resistance. Thanks so much. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. And that was Professor, Movement Lawyer, and co-founder of Black August Los Angeles, James Simmons, talking to us about the commemoration, its traditions, and relevance today. Families, neighborhoods, and whole communities across the country continue to experience the harmful reverberations of the unwinding of Haitian temporary protective status, even as the temporary protective status of other countries come to an end. Pleased to be joined now by Ronald Claude to check in on how communities are navigating this moment and how they're showing up for each other. Ronald Claude is the Haitian American Director of Policy and Advocacy at the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, also known as BAJI. Greetings, Ronald. So good to have you on.
Hi, Nana. How are you?
I am all right. I'm continuing to try to defeat the regime, so.
An endeavor we keep going with.
Speaking of that, definitely wanted to have you on to update people on what is happening, what's the mood, what's the mode happening with our Haitian siblings after the wind down of the benefits and that come with temporary protective status, and wanting to give folks a sense of like where people are at, our Haitian siblings in this moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that. And you know, I'll be remiss if I don't also share how this is impacting some other Black communities, like our Ethiopian brothers and sisters. And if it has not happened, it will, you know, see our folks on Sudanese TPS. So it's something that a lot of our communities are about to experience or in the midst of experiencing right now. And so to your question about the Haitians from TPS and the wind down of that status, it's quite frankly been, you know, very debilitating because of the fact that some of the folks that have had TPS, you know, now all of a sudden aren't able to go to work, are unsure whether they can go to the grocery store to pick up, you know, groceries for their family. Don't know what are they going to do with the bills that are coming up in terms of, you know, their housing or their car situation. And, you know, just also just living in fear, which is so demoralizing as well as unsafe and just traumatic when you feel like, what if I get stopped? You know, just not even for, you know, doing anything crazy, but like, oh, I jaywalked. And now all of a sudden an ankle monitor's on your bracelet, on your ankle, or worse, you know, you're deported. And so it's been something where you're seeing a lot of the community confused. Unfortunately, in the same time, there's a lot of information that is not accurate being spread. And then also you're seeing maybe what I think is where you can find hope is that a lot of the community coming together to try to show up for each other in this time, try to make something out of nothing in terms of making sure Know Your Rights information is translated into Haitian Creole, making sure that they're attending events that are about, you know, how to access, you know, different, potentially different statuses and, you know, passing the word on to other, you know, friends and families that have similar situations. And also just quite frankly, wanting to be active, trying to, you know, be the difference that they want to see, but also not go quietly into the night. And trying to make sure that, you know, they know that this their community, they are a real part of it. And it's not going to just be because of, you know, racism and skewed decisions by courts and whatnot for them to not have a place in that community anymore.
Yeah, really important that they, you know, there's fear, but then there's also community. And as our sibling comrade Andrea Ritchie says, there is courage in community. So great that people are pulling together in that kind of way. I know with Baji, Black Alliance for Just Immigration, I'm the executive director, you are the director of policy and advocacy, that there's some work that we are doing in coalition with some other leaders to try to deal with this beyond TPS situation. One piece of this is trying to deal with the immediate. And you did talk about some of what folks are doing across the country. It's a lot of organizations. I'm not even trying to pretend that Baji's the only one, but across the country to try to address the immediate concerns and needs. And, you know, when it comes to the potentials for immigration enforcement and the fear that people have around that, talk about some of the things that Baji and, you know, other leaders are doing that other folks that are listening right now may feel like, oh, maybe it's something I can plug into.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I think for us at Baji, we've been really trying to figure out ways that we are building to build a coalition, right? And coalition in the sense of not just when in danger, you know, scream and shout, but in the sense of like, okay, what is our strategy in the long term and what is our strategy for tomorrow? And so we have a weekly meeting, which is beyond Haitian TPS, again, that you described a little bit. And we meet weekly into different subgroups of we have a mutual aid group, a rapid response group / emergency preparedness, and a yes coalition. And those three categories, I think, is what we're trying to, you know, support the community with in this time. With the mutual aid, we understand that things are happening and people need support for tomorrow, right? And so it's like, yeah, we have TPS and we hope for permanent protection, but, you know, there's things tomorrow because of this new status change or this new thing that I have to, you know, live through. I don't know how I'm going to do XYZ. And so that group is focused on trying to make plans that's not just about, okay, how can we directly hand out money or directly hand out resources, but also how are we making sure that, hey, folks that are plugged in, the folks that do know where these things are, how can we build a bank of information so folk, the Haitian community, can go to that and feel supported and know that people are working on that front? Then you have the rapid response and emergency preparedness aspect of, we're seeing the videos online, right, of folks, you know, having ankle monitors put on them as they're screaming and shouting, and, you know, just living your life, being Black is going to be a reason to be, you know, maybe it makes it, you're afraid to go outside. So this emergency preparedness and rapid response group, this is an area where we're trying to say, how can we show up for our community? Not just in the sense of like, you know your rights, but really be there for them, right? If you have a court date or you know a date to go to ICE facilities, you're somewhat, we're creating a group of people that are going to be willing to maybe go with you to make sure no funny business happens, you know, whether it is to pass out whistles to, you know, alert folks that ICE is in the on the block or in the community, right? So thinking of it from an active participation standpoint and creating a group of folks that understand that, you know, showing up for each other in a rapid response is not just like, it's not something that is beyond our everyday capabilities. It's just sometimes, quite frankly, being a good neighbor. So how do we build those practices and how do we build it where more folks are able to participate and support Haitian community at this time? And then finally, the Yes Coalition. You know, again, we've kind of talked a little bit about it, but specifically, we know that there's a lot of orgs and a lot of advocacy around trying to figure out a different way to extend TPS, to provide some type of stopgap or safety for the immediate future or for tomorrow, right? And that's important. But we also know the reason we're here is because we need to do more to have our bottom line, our North Star, be permanent protection. And so the Yes To Coalition is really focused on, okay, you know, we're that's great that some folks are focusing on how to extend TPS. We want to talk about, hey, if there is going to be a shift in Congress, it's going to be a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House, you know, how can we make sure that on the top of their agenda, all the folks on TPS, all the folks on DACA, all the folks that had DED have a pathway to permanent citizenship, right? And that is also without criminal bars, which is very important because we're not just going to take anything anymore. We want to create a coalition that understands like this, we're done eating low-hanging fruit. We want the top of the tree, we want the best apple available, and that is permanent protections. And so trying to build a coalition and try to figure out different ways that we can do that advocacy and make that clear to electeds on the federal side, you know, on senators and House representatives, but also even on the city and, you know, city and state side, too, because I think it's very important that that coalition also changes the frame of that our dignity is not attached to a value of how much we produce economically. Right. And that's a lot of what the conversation had been on the onset of this was that, oh, these Haitians are such great workers. We shouldn't be doing this to them. No, these are people and we shouldn't be doing this to them. And so I think that is what one of the things we're trying to do with the Yes Coalition is shift the narrative. Shift the demand, and most importantly, understand that there's a long-term strategy and vision that we actually have to start working on today, so we're not behind the eight ball, you know, if there is an opportunity to make some type of legislation that will actually bring the calm, the safety, and the long-term stability that all the folks that have had TPS are, you know, in desperate want of.
Makes me want to go. Let's go. I'm like, all right, let's make it happen. Let's get it together. If folks also are feeling that way and want to plug in, understanding that, you know, Baji is a national organization. So yes, we're in California, but we are across the country. How do people connect up with Baji? How do people learn more? How do people plug in if they're interested in joining those weekly meetings?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and we have an answer for you. The first thing is to reach out to policy@baji.org. You know, it's our email. If you reach out, we can put you on our email listserv. We can send you the calendar invite, the Zoom registration, et cetera. And so you can join us on the Beyond Haitian TPS meetings, which happen weekly every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern. Which I believe is 2 o'clock Pacific. Please don't quote me.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes, I did the math right. But nonetheless, those are ways that you can join us. And again, if you reach out to policy@baji.org, you can also follow us on our socials at Insta@Baji. You'll be able to find that information, see what we're doing in real time, and also plug in not only to the work we're doing for the Haitian community, but just in general, the situation is all built off of each other, right? What we're seeing, how ICE is operating in our communities with free rein and just, you know, throwing terror around and, you know, police budgets getting increased, we have work and opportunities to engage that will impact, you know, the Haitian community, the Ethiopian community, and just Black people generally in a positive manner. So we also have like a STOP framework and a Break the Ice Machine work that we're doing. And if there's a webinar, if you're interested in that, on August 27th. So there's a lot of work that we have going on. And if you're interested, again, the best way to start is policy@bhaji.org.
Thank you so very much, Ronald. We really appreciate your leadership and all that you're doing. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
You as well. Thank you.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. And that was Bhaji, Director of Policy and Advocacy, Ronald Claude, on the unwinding of Haitian TPS and how community members and allies are showing up and fighting back. More Sojourner Truth with our conversation with Florida State Representative Angie Nixon after this short break.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
I woke up this morning, there were tears in my bed. They killed a man I really loved, they shot him through the head. Lord, Lord, they cut George Jackson down. Lord, Lord, they laid him in the ground. Sent him off to prison for a $70 rivalry. They closed the door behind him and they threw away the key. Lord, Lord, they cut George Jackson down. Lord, Lord, they laid him in the ground.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. In a stunning turn of events, Florida State Representative Angie Nixon has won the Democratic primary in Florida. And she did so fully embracing the Working Families Party, the Democratic Socialist Party, and other progressive platforms and positions in the state that gave us Ron DeSantis, Mar-a-Lago, and so-called alligator Alcatraz. Pleased to share the interview that we did here with her on Sojourner Truth in May of this year, before talking with Representative Nixon was cool. Greetings, Representative Nixon. How are you today?
Hey, Nana, I am great. I'm excited to be here with, you know what? I am not great. I'm going to be honest with you, but I am excited to be here with you all today. I'm not great because democracy is falling. Our country is falling. And, you know, I was arrested the other day for standing up for the rights of people.
Yes. This is why I wanted to speak with you, because it's just outrageous what is happening when we talk about this continuing crumbling of democracy that's just being hastened by folks that are in power, thinking about, and the reason I wanted definitely to speak with you is just the image of you speaking up in that pink suit, letting folks know this is unconstitutional as Florida moved to grab power away from Black folks who are an integral part of who consists of Florida, who Floridians are. And so talk about what is happening first, just to level set for our listeners. What is happening with this redistricting in Florida?
Yeah, for sure. So I think it's really important to rewind back to 2022, actually. So in 2022, Ron DeSantis then unconstitutionally removed two black congressional districts. He drew maps with his office drew maps, which is not what his duty is as governor. It's actually the constitutional obligation of the state legislators to draw the maps, number one. And then number two, like, he removed black congressional districts in Central Florida as well as North Florida, basically eliminating the seat that Val Demings held as well as the seat that Al Lawson held. And what's really important about highlighting the seat that Al Lawson held is because Corrine Brown held that seat before him, and she was the first congressperson post-Reconstruction. And so now, fast forward back to 2026, Ron DeSantis decided to take up the call of what Donald Trump requested of Republican governors, which was to find him some more seats so that he can have allies in Congress. And Ron DeSantis decided to do just that. And what's interesting is they did in the state of Florida mid-decade redistricting. And we normally take months to go through maps and draw maps and all the things. This literally took like a weekend. And then the maps were actually, he called a special session for it. The maps were actually released to Fox News before they were released to state lawmakers. And they were color-coded in blue and red. And there was a map that showed how many blue seats or Democratic seats there were with this current map. And then the new map that they were drawing showed how four seats were basically being eliminated to draw more like Republican districts. And so that illustrates that it was partisan. It was done in a partisan fashion. What is concerning and what the issue is that back in 2010, voters came together and placed a ballot amendment, a citizen-led ballot amendment on the ballot back in 2010 that was called Fair Districts. And it called for drawing of maps not in a partisan fashion. Like, it's illegal. It made it illegal. So this constitutional amendment passed overwhelmingly with over 60% of voters supporting the Fair Districts Amendment. And it says, again, like I stated, you cannot gerrymander the state in a partisan fashion. And so that is exactly what Ron DeSantis did. And that is what the Republicans voted to do in the state of Florida. And so that is illegal, it's unconstitutional, and it's wrong. And it is exactly why I decided to get up there on the House floor and disrupt with my pink bullhorn. And then going back to 2022, I want folks to note that, like, I have been nothing short of consistent. I also disrupted the proceedings back in 2022 when I realized that it was illegal and unconstitutional as well. And so I decided to do it again this year. And it's just very frustrating that this is happening. I am excited that Mark Elias and Equal Ground have decided to file a lawsuit as it relates to these maps. They had the first opening arguments happened on last Friday. And so now we're just waiting on the state Supreme Court to make their decision in regards to whether or not they're going to throw the maps out or they're going to allow them to stand. And I want to highlight and to note that in addition to Friday's hearing, right, regarding the maps, some of us had a rally outside of the courthouse. And then, I'm sorry, it wasn't the state Supreme Court. It was a lower court. But they had a rally. And so then we marched over to the governor's office to try to schedule a meeting with him and to highlight the need for him to basically redraw the maps in the right way that is legal and according to the Fair Districts Amendment that have been embedded in the state constitution. And so we went over there. He wasn't there. We also requested to speak with a staffer. They stated a staffer was going to come, and a staffer never came. What came was Capitol Police, and they arrested four of us at the Capitol because we would not leave, and we wanted to have a conversation.
And they will do that, which is really unfortunate. But the racists are... You know, the racists are racisting. The racists are racisting and really trying to push their power as much as possible. Interesting as you're talking, thinking about that arc, because we know that the Supreme Court decision in Calais is not something that just happened out of the blue. We know that there has been for decades now, really ever since the Voting Rights Act passed, and the enforcement aspect of it on the federal side was enacted and pushed, that there's been this effort to claw back at this really, you know, recently gained. It's been 50 years, but that is, or 60 years, but that is recent, right? This recently gained right to vote that has always had all of these impediments put up for Black people. So I want to focus really on the Black aspect of this, because I think, you know, the Supreme Court's decision makes it seem as if having Black electoral power, that Black people being able to elect representatives that come from our communities, that reflect us, is no longer important. And so as a Black representative yourself, wanting to hear from you a little bit about that, the importance. Why does it still matter in the year of our Lord 2026 for there to be Black people representing Black people from the local to the federal?
Yeah, so it's really important for Black folks to have representation by people who have the same lived experiences as them, because we know what the issues and concerns are. We know how we need, our communities need to be resourced more so than folks who can sometimes empathize, right? But may not have like lived in that experience. Like that may not be their lived experience. You know, the microaggressions, the systemic racism. It's just overall a good thing to also just to see someone who looks like you sometimes in those positions, because I know some young folks are like, oh my gosh, like I can do something positive when they come up to me and they see me and they see that I'm just, you know, a regular everyday person who has my locks, right? Who has my nose ring and all the things, who knows and has experienced microaggressions or who has experienced racism or bigotry just based on how I present. And so also, like, I am a mom. I was a single mom for like 12 years. And that, unfortunately, is the experience of some folks within our community. And so I legislate from that place, knowing that it's important for us to ensure that we have access to affordable, our communities have access to affordable childcare, right? It's important for me to push things like Medicare for All, because I know that in a Black community, there are such huge health disparities in regards to heart disease, diabetes, maternal health, as well as, you know, infant health. Like infant mortality is really high within the Black community. And so these are all things that have impacted me and impacted my family and impacted the community that looks like me. And so we definitely need more representation, because folks are more apt to work on issues that that community has if they've experienced them before themselves personally.
Talking to community about this attack on voting rights is people not really understanding what we can lose.
Yeah.
What do we lose, right? And I think people feel like, well, you know, what are we getting out of voting? There's so many people that are disaffected in our communities that are voters, right? So we have this interesting black math, as I call it, right? Where we have people who are really into voting, super voters in the black community that are really strong and just a grand, strong voting bloc. And then we have so many other folks in our community that are disaffected voters, right? That are voters in waiting, that are feeling like, you know, what is the point? And so because they see what is happening, you know, everything's been taken over in their mind by the Epstein class. They're watching decisions be made that are against our communities. They're watching decisions be made that, you know, they absolutely don't agree with. And so they feel like, you know, we're putting these people in office, but what is it doing for me? And so they're not necessarily seeing that direct connection between voting and improving the conditions of their lives. So what would you say briefly is the reason that people should be concerned, whether they're in our communities or outside of our communities, about Black folks having an voting power?
Yeah, so I think it's important to note that the reason a lot of this stuff is going haywire in our democracy and our country is just basically falling apart is because we have allowed politicians who are bought and paid for by these rich folks, super, super ultra wealthy, right? Greedy billionaires and these corrupt corporations to actually make the policy decisions. And so I would say that we need to flip that. We need to reverse uno on them. We need to ensure that we start electing people who are just regular everyday folks to office. Right now, oh my gosh, someone just sent me a text message with an article that came out just even about the state of Florida lawmakers in the state legislature. And this is basically, you know, the same in DC. There was only 7 state lawmakers with a negative net worth. There were several that were multi-millionaires. There were tons with net worth of over $500,000, but overwhelmingly, like, there were very few with negative net worth. And just think about, like, the Black community and, like, what our net worth is right now and what a lot of just not even just the Black community, but just hardworking everyday folks. Our net worths are zero or below. I gladly wear the badge that my net worth, I was one of the 7 lawmakers with the negative net worth because I have a home that I'm still paying on. And that is not, you know, like, so I owe more money than I have right now. And I also have 5 kids with my husband and this blended family. And so I have only put forth legislation that could actually benefit hardworking everyday people. And it's the exact opposite of the majority of the lawmakers, right? The majority of the lawmakers have only put forth legislation that benefits really like these greedy corporations, right? And it shows because many of them work for these corporations, or they receive a ton of money from these corporations, or they're making laws about, you know, helping the wealthy and the richer get richer because they are wealthy and richer. And so at a minimum, if we want someone to start putting forth legislation that would address issues like ensuring that Social Security is solvent and that it actually, the amount that people can claim on Social Security, these seniors, because right now it's not enough for them to even just live and they've worked their entire lives. They shouldn't have to go back to work. We need to be making sure that we elect people who believe we need to fully fund Social Security, that we need to tax these billionaires and make sure that these 88 companies like from last year that made over $105 billion and didn't pay anything in federal taxes, making sure that they do in fact pay federal taxes so we can ensure that our Social Security system is again solvent and that we have things like Medicare for All. I believe that we can have a great country that is beneficial to everyone and that could help people not just survive but thrive if we elect folks like janitors and bus drivers, nurses, teachers, paraprofessionals, you know, construction workers. Like, if we had those type of people writing policies, can you imagine the type of country that we would be living in right now? It would look completely different from what's happening right now. And so that at a minimum is why people need to make sure that they're registered. They make sure that they ask their friends and family to ensure that they're registered as well. And they need to go out to vote just so that they can have someone who is supporting their interest.
And let's talk about this registering and voting, because I think some of the narrative that those white supremacists that would suppress us want us to think is that they've got us cornered, that by redistricting, that in and of itself has created this situation that we can't get out of, right? That they have basically broken up the possibility, not just cut off the head of the snake, but cut the snake into little pieces, basically, with the hope that that is it and that, you know, we'll be crushed. And I take the position that the math breaks the maps.
Mm-hmm.
That mm-hmm. actually, if people go out and vote in the numbers that actually reflect what our registration or what our eligibility, even more correctly, is that we will find that you cannot, you know, no borders, that we are breaking the borders and that we are voting across borders. And that if we do that, then the math breaks the maps. What are your mm-hmm. thoughts on that?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. There's no amount of gerrymandering that can keep us down if we go out to vote, right? Like we have to, it's particularly with these at large districts, right? So these statewide offices or at large districts in your local municipalities and that type of thing, like we can actually win and start changing things like your governor's races, your U.S. Senate races, your mayoral races, your at large commission and city council races. We can actually start building power in those areas if we make sure that we go out and vote in record numbers. Yes, you can. You can. The math can break the maps. You are exactly right.
Yeah, that's, I'm getting a t-shirt. I'm making a t-shirt, Rep Nixon. I'll send one to you.
Please do.
The math breaks the maps. And thinking about who this affects, also thinking about the breadth of it, right? Because I think a lot of times the conversation is around congressional, for example, the conversation, you know, whether that be Senate or whether that be House. But when this redistricting happens, it also impacts city electoral positions. It could also impact school districts, for example, these other places where even in a place like Florida that may not have, you know, may have tried to gerrymander its way into supermajorities and all these other spaces, on the local level, we still have a lot of Black folks on the state legislature, on county legislatures, school districts, cities, right, where, again, this type of effort to racially gerrymander impacts our communities if we don't push back.
Right. And so, I mean, we just got to come out. We got to register folks. We have to vote. We also need to look, y'all, like we folks need to run for office, right? Like, especially if you are organizers, like all the things. Now is the time, right? Like we need different visions for our country than what is currently in office. And so I'm telling folks, like, folks need to get organized and really get folks, like, start meeting people where they are to educate them about how, if they don't do politics, politics is definitely doing them right now at the gas pump, at the grocery store. If we want better, we have to vote. We have to hold people accountable after they get in office. And we also need to look at doing some things like some mass boycotts and potentially talking about some mass strikes. We got to hit these people in their pocketbook because it seems like all they know is money right now. And we saw what happened with Target. And so we can do that on a bigger, larger scale.
That leads to my last question. Yes, you are a representative, a state representative, and you're doing, you know, what needs to be done in the state house, but then you're also in community and community knows you, you're tapped in. How is community responding on the organizing front, right? Because we've got the legislative piece, we've got the judicial piece, and you talked earlier about the fact that there's a lawsuit, but organizing is what gets the goods. And so what are you seeing on the ground from folks in Florida, Black folks in particular, and allies as well?
Yeah, I'm seeing great things. People are tired and they're frustrated with the BS that's happening. And so folks are starting to join organizations to do the work. And they are excited about, they're excited around candidates that are unapologetic and seemingly have a backbone and aren't afraid to speak out even when they break decorum. And so like folks are starting to join, like I say, starting to join organizations, starting to knock on doors and make phone calls. And really just popping up, educating folks, you know, I think we need to go back to the organizing models of like what the Black Panther Party did, because they addressed a lot of the needs. And so we have to look at some mutual aid in addition to just the organizing. You know, the Black Panther Party saw that kids were going to school hungry. And so they started the free breakfast program, which has now been replicated across our country in public schools. And they also saw that folks didn't have access to quality health care. And so they started those free health clinics. And so they were able to build political power because they tapped into the needs of the people and illustrated that government was failing them and it didn't have to be this way. And so we need to like really look at the needs that our folks are needing and are the things that they're suffering from. And like, what can we do right now as a community to help assist them with? And then like pointing out the failure of our government. Like our government is here to help better the lives of people when the market fails, right? And when there is like issues and concerns, and that's not what's happening right now. They're only looking out for the issues and concerns of the wealthy and of the elite. And so I am starting to see more of that, Nana. And so I'm excited about that. And it is frustrating that people's backs had to get to a wall, right? For them to say, you know what, things need to change. It's like, no, things should have been changed, but I get it. But welcome on board and let's do this.
Welcome on board and let's do this. Thank you so very much, Representative Nixon. Really, really appreciate you. And, you know, we got your back. We're going to make sure that these folks can't just do whatever they want to do. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. And that was my conversation a few months ago with Florida State Representative Angie Nixon. And that's our show. I'd like to thank our guests. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth family. I'd like to thank our board operator, Coltrane, and our producer, Gary Scott, and of course, you for joining us. Let's get together at the same time and place next week for Sojourner Truth Radio. Be well.
There are many ways to support the programs that you love on KPFK. Becoming a member, starting a monthly gift, donating a vehicle that you don't need anymore. And now, donating a piece of land or other real estate. More about the advantages of donating real estate is at kpfk.org.
Support for KPFK is brought to you in part by Tangent Productions, presenting an evening of reggae roots and island-inspired music featuring Catch a Fire, Long Beach Dub All-Stars, Through the Roots, and Tomorrow's Bad Seeds. This multi-generational lineup brings together international reggae ambassadors, SoCal legends, and rising voices in modern roots music for a full night of live performances. The